From the studios of Books and Motion in Spokane, Washington, this is Cameron Byerly reading The Belgariad, Queen of Sorcery, by David Eddings. We begin with the prologue. Being an account of the Battle of the Kingdoms of the West against the invasion of Khal Torak, based upon the Battle of Vomembre. In the youth of the world, the evil god Torak stole the orb of Aldur and fled seeking dominion. The orb resisted, and its fire maimed him with a dreadful burning. But he would not give it up, for it was precious to him. Then Belgarath, a sorcerer and a disciple of the god Aldur, led forth the king of the Alorns and his three sons, and they reclaimed the orb from the iron tower of Torak. Torak sought to pursue, but the wrath of the orb repelled him and drove him back. Belgarath set Kerak and his sons to be kings over four great kingdoms, an eternal guard against Torak. The orb he gave to Rhitha Irongrip to keep, saying that so long as a descendant of Rhitha held the orb, the West would be safe. Century followed upon century, with no menace from Torak, until the spring of 4865, when Draznea was invaded by a vast horde of Nadraks, Tulls, and Murgos. In the center of this sea of Angaraks was born the huge iron pavilion of Khal Torak, which means king and god. Cities and villages were razed and burned, for Khal Torak came to destroy, not to conquer. Those of the people who lived were given to the steel-masked Gurlum priests for sacrifice in the unspeakable rites of the Angaraks. None survived save those who fled to Algeria, or were taken from the mouth of the Aldur River by Kerak warships. Next, the horde struck south at Algeria, but there they found no cities. The nomadic Algerian horsemen fell back before them, then struck in vicious hit-and-run attacks. The traditional seat of the Algerian kings was the Stronghold, a man-made mountain with stone walls 30 feet thick. Against this the Angaraks hurled themselves in vain before settling down to besiege the place. The siege lasted for 8 futile years. This gave the West time to mobilize and prepare. The generals gathered at the Imperial War College at Tolhanath and planned their strategy. National differences were set aside, and Brand, the warder of Rhiva, was chosen to have full command. With him came 2 strange advisers, an ancient but vigorous man who claimed knowledge even of the Angarak kingdoms, and a strikingly handsome woman with a silver lock at her brow and an imperious manner. To these Brand listened, and to them he paid almost deferential respect. In the late spring of 4875, Khal Torak abandoned his siege and turned west toward the sea, pursued still by Algar horsemen. In the mountains, the Ulgos came forth from their caverns by night, and wreaked fearful slaughter on the sleeping Angaraks. But still the forces of Khal Torak were beyond counting. After a pause to regroup, the host proceeded down the valley of the river Arend toward the city of Vomembre, destroying all in its path. Early in the summer the Angaraks deployed for the assault upon the city. On the 3rd day of the battle a horn was heard to blow 3 times. Then the gates of Vomembre opened, and the membrate knights charged out to fall upon the front of the Angarak horde, the iron-shod hoofs of their chargers trampling living and dead. From the left came Algar cavalry, Draznian pikemen, and veiled Ulgo irregulars. And from the right came the Cherak berserks and legions of Tonedra. Attacked on 3 sides, Khal Torak committed his reserves. It was then that the gray-clad ravens and sendars and the Asturian archers came upon his forces from the rear. the Angoraks fell like mown wheat and were overcome by confusion. Then the apostate, Zidar, the sorcerer, went in haste into the black iron pavilion, from which Kal Torak had not yet emerged. And to the accursed one he said,
Lord, thine enemies have thee surrounded in great numbers. Yea, even the grey ravens have come in their numbers to cast their defiance into thy teeth.
Kal Torak rose in anger and declared,
I will come forth. And the false keepers of Tranyaska, the jewel which was mine, shall see me and know fear of me. Send to me my kings.
Great lord, Zedar told him, thy kings are no more. The battle has claimed their lives, and those of a multitude of thy Grodom priests as well.
Kal Torak's wrath grew at these words, and fire flared in his right eye, and from the eye that was not. He ordered his servants to bind his shield to the arm on which he had no hand, and he took up his dread black sword. With this he went forth to do war. Then came a voice from the midst of the ravens, saying,
In the name of Belar I defy thee, Torak. In the name of Aldur I cast my despite in thy teeth. Let the bloodshed be abated, and I will meet thee to decide the battle. I am Brand, warder of Riva. Meet me, or take thy stinking host away, and come no more against the kingdoms of the West.
Kal Torak strode apart from the host and cried,
Where is he who dares pit his mortal flesh against the king of the world? Behold, I am Torak. King of kings and lord of lords, I will destroy this loud-voiced raven. Mine enemies shall perish, and Sranyaska shall again be mine.
Brand stood forth. He bore a mighty sword and a shield muffled with cloth. A grizzled wolf marched at his side, and a snowy owl hovered over his head. And he spake, saying,
I am Brand, and I will contend with thee, foul and misshapen Torak.
When Torak saw the wolf, he said,
Begone, Belgarath, flee, if thou wouldst save thy life.
And to the owl he said,
Abjure thy father, Polgara, and worship me. I will wed thee. And make thee queen of the world.
But the wolf howled defiance, and the owl screeched her scorn. Torak raised his sword and smote down upon the shield of Brand. Long they fought, and many and grievous were the wounds and blows they struck. Those who stood near to see them were amazed. The fury of Torak grew great, and his sword battered the shield of Brand, until the warder fell back before the onslaught of the accursed one. And then the wolf howled, and the owl shrieked in one voice together, and the strength of Brand was renewed. With a single motion, the raven warder unveiled his shield, in the center of which stood a round jewel, in size like the heart of a child. As Torak gazed upon it, the stone began to glow into flame. The accursed one drew back from it. He dropped his shield and sword and raised his arms before his face to ward away the dread fire of the stone. Brand struck, and his sword pierced Torak's visor to strike into the eye which was not, and to plunge into the accursed one's head. Torak fell back and gave a great cry. He plucked out the sword and threw off his helmet. Those who watched recoiled in terror, for his face was seared by some great fire, and was horrible to behold. Weeping blood, Torak cried out again, as he beheld the jewel which he had named Tragaska, and for which he had brought his war into the West. Then he collapsed, and the earth resounded with his fall. A great cry went up from the host of the Angoraks when they saw what had befallen Kal Torak, and they sought to flee in their panic. But the armies of the west pursued them and slew them, so that when the smoky dawn broke on the fourth day, the host was no more. Brand asked that the body of the accursed one be brought to him, that he might behold him who would be king of all the world. But the body was not to be found, for in the night Zadar the sorcerer had cast an enchantment and passed unseen through the armies of the west, bearing away the one he had chosen as master. Then Brand took counsel with his advisers, and Belgarath said to him, "Torek is not dead. He only sleeps, for he is a god and cannot be slain by any mortal weapon." "When will he awaken?" Brand asked. "I must prepare the west against his return."
Volvara answered, "When once again a king of Riva's line sits on his northern throne, the dark god will waken to do war with him."
Brand frowned, saying, "But that is never." For all knew that the last Riven king had been slain with his family in 4002 by Nissen assassins. Again the woman spoke,
"In the fullness of time, the Riven king will rise to claim his own, as the ancient prophecy foretells. More cannot be said."
Brand was content, and set his armies to cleansing the battlefield of the wreckage of the Angoraks. And when that was finished, the kings of the west gathered before the city of Omimbre and held council. Many were the voices raised in praise of Brand. Soon men began crying that Brand should henceforth be chosen as ruler of all of the west. Only Magon, ambassador of Imperial Tol Nedra, protested in the name of his emperor, Ranbarun IV. Brand refused the honor, and the proposal was dropped, so that there was again peace among those assembled in council. But in return for peace, a demand was made of Tol Nedra. Vigoram of the Olgos spoke first in a loud voice,
"In fulfillment of the prophecy, thou must be promised a princess of Tol Nedra to be wife unto the Riven King, who will come to save the world. This the gods require of us."
Again Magon protested,
"The hall of the Riven King is empty and desolate. No king sits upon the Riven throne. How may a princess of Imperial Tol Nedra be wed with a phantom?"
Then the woman who was Pogara replied,
"The Riven King will return to assume his throne and claim his bride. From this day forward, therefore, each princess of Imperial Tol Nedra shall present herself in the hall of the Riven King upon her 16th birthday. She shall be clad in her wedding gown, and shall abide there for 3 days against the coming of the king. If he comes not to claim her, then she shall be free to return to her father for whatever he may decree for her."
Magon cried out, "Our Tol Nedra shall rise against this indignity. No, it shall not be."
The wise Gorim of the Ulgos spoke again,
"Tell your emperor that this is the will of the gods. Tell him also that in the day Tol Nedra fails in this, the west shall rise against him, and scatter the sons of Nedra to the winds, and pull down the might of the empire, until Imperial Tol Nedra is no more."
At that, seeing the might of the armies before him, the ambassador submitted to the matter. All then agreed, and were bound to it. When that was done, the nobles of strife-torn Orindia came to Brand, saying, "The king of the Mimbrates is dead, and the duke of the Asturians also. Who now shall rule us? For 2,000 years has war between Mimbre and Asturia rent fair Orindia. How may we become one people again?" Brand considered,
"Who is heir to the Mimbrate throne?"
"Corodulan is crown prince of the Mimbrates," the nobles replied.
unto whom descends the Asturian line?
Maya Serena is the daughter of the Asturian duke, they told him.
Brand said, Bring them to me. And when they were brought before Brand, he said to them, The bloodshed between Mimbre and Asturia must end. Therefore, it is my will that you be wed to each other, and that the houses which so long have warred shall thus be joined. The two cried against the judgment, for they were filled with ancient enmity and with pride of their separate lines. But Belgarath took Corodulan aside and spoke in private with him. And Polgara withdrew Maya Serena to a separate place and was long in converse with her. No man learned then, or later, what was said to the two young people. But when they returned to where Brand waited, Maya Serena and Corodulan were content that they should be wed. And this was the final act of the council that met after the Battle of Vomimbre. Brand spoke to all of the kings and nobles one final time before departing for the north.
Much has been wrought here that is good and shall endure. Behold, we have joined together against the Angoraks, and they have been overthrown. Torak is quelled, and the covenant we have made here among us prepares the west for the day of the prophecy, when the Riven King shall return, and Torak shall wake from his long sleep to contend again for empire and dominion. All that may be done in this day to prepare for the great and final war has been done. We can do no more. And here, perchance, the wounds of Arindia have been healed, and the strife of more than 2,000 years may see its end. So far as may be, I am content with it all. Hail, then, and farewell.
He turned from them and rode north with the grizzled man who was Belgarath, and the queenly woman who was Polgara by his side. They took ship at Camar in Sindaria, and set sail for Riva, and Brand returned no more to the kingdoms of the west. But of his companions are many tales told, and of that telling, what may be true and what false, few men may know. Part 1. Arindia. Chapter 1. Vo Wachun was no more. 24 centuries had passed since the city of the Wasaitarins had been laid waste and the dark, endless forests of northern Arindia had reclaimed the ruins. Broken walls had toppled and been swallowed up in the moss and wet brown bracken of the forest floor, and only the shattered stumps of the once proud towers moldered among the trees and fog to mark the place where Vo Wachun had stood. Sodden snow blanketed the mist-shrouded ruins, and trickles of water ran down the faces of ancient stones, like tears. Geryon wandered alone down the tree-choked avenues of the dead city, his stout gray wool cloak drawn tight against the chill, and his thoughts as mournful as the weeping stones around him. Faldor's farm, with its green, sun-drenched fields, was so far behind him that it seemed lost in a kind of receding haze, and he was desperately homesick. No matter how hard he tried to hold on to them, details kept escaping him. The rich smells of Aunt Paul's kitchen were only a faint memory. The ring of Durnak's hammer in the smithy faded like the dying echo of the last note of a bell. And the sharp, clear faces of his playmates wavered in his remembrance of them until he could no longer be sure that he would even recognize them. His childhood was slipping away, and try though he might, he could not hold on to it. Everything was changing. That was the whole problem. The core of his life, the rock upon which his childhood had been built, had always been Aunt Paul. In the simple world of Faldor's farm, she had been Mistress Paul, the cook. But in the world beyond Faldor's gate, she was Polgara the sorceress,
who had watched the passage of 3 millennia with a purpose beyond mortal comprehension. And Mr. Wolfe, the old vagabond storyteller, had also changed. Garrigan knew now that his old friend was in fact his great-great-grandfather, with an infinite number of additional greats added on for good measure. But that behind that roguish old face there had always been the steady gaze of Belgarath, the sorcerer, who had watched and waited as he had looked upon the folly of men and gods for 7,000 years. Garion sighed and trudged on through the fog. Their very names were unsettling. Garion had never wanted to believe in sorcery or magic or witchcraft. Such things were unnatural, and they violated his notion of solid, sensible reality. But too many things had happened to allow him to hold on to his comfortable skepticism any longer. In a single shattering instant, the last vestiges of his doubt had been swept away. As he had watched with stunned disbelief, Aunt Paul had erased the milky stains from the eyes of Martia the witch with a gesture and a single word. Restoring the madwoman's sight and removing her power to see into the future with a brutal even-handedness. Garion shuddered at the memory of Martia's despairing wail. That cry somehow marked the point at which the world had become less solid, less sensible, and infinitely less safe. Uprooted from the only place he had ever known, unsure of the identities of the two people closest to him, and with his whole conception of the difference between the possible and the impossible destroyed, Garion found himself committed to a strange pilgrimage. He had no idea what they were doing in this shattered city, swallowed up in trees, and not the faintest idea where they would go when they left. The only certainty that remained to him was the single grim thought to which he now clung. Somewhere in the world, there was a man who had crept through the pre-dawn darkness to a small house in a forgotten village and had murdered Garion's parents. If it took him the rest of his life, Garion was going to find that man, and when he found him, he was going to kill him. There was something strangely comforting in that one solid fact. He carefully climbed over the rubble of a house that had fallen outward into the street and continued his gloomy exploration of the ruined city. There was really nothing to see. The patient centuries had erased nearly all of what the war had left behind, and slushy snow and thick fog hid even those last remaining traces. Garion sighed again, and began to retrace his steps toward the moldering stump of the tower where they had all spent the previous night. As he approached, he saw Mistress Wolfe and Aunt Paul standing together some distance from the ruined tower, talking quietly. The old man's rust-colored hood was turned up, and Aunt Paul's blue cloak was drawn about her. There was a look of timeless regret on her face as she looked out at the foggy ruins. Her long dark hair spilled down her back, and the single white lock at her brow seemed paler than the snow at her feet. "There he is now," Mr. Wolfe said to her as Garion approached them. She nodded and looked gravely at Garion.
"Where have you been?" "No place. I was thinking, that's all." "I see you've managed to soak your feet."
Garion lifted one of his sodden brown boots and looked down at the muddy slush clinging to it.
"The snow's wetter than I thought," he apologized.
"Does wearing that thing really make you feel better?"
Mr. Wolfe asked, pointing at the sword Garion always wore now.
"Everybody keeps saying how dangerous Arendia is," Garion explained. "Besides, I need to get used to it."
He shifted the creaking new leather sword belt around until the wire-bound hilt was not so obvious.
The sword had been an Eristide present from Barak, one of several gifts he had received when the holiday had passed while they were at sea.
"It doesn't really suit you, you know," the old man told him somewhat disapprovingly.
"Leave him alone, father,"
Aunt Paul said almost absently.
"It is his, after all, and he can wear it if he likes."
"Shouldn't Hetar be here by now?" Garion asked, wanting to change the subject.
"He may have run into deep snow in the mountains of Sindaria," Wolf replied. "He will be here. Hetar's very dependable."
"I don't see why we just didn't buy horses in Kamar."
"They would not have been as good,"
Mr. Wolf answered,
scratching at his short white beard. "We've got a long way to go, and I don't want to have to worry about a horse foundering under me somewhere along the way. It's a lot better to take a little time now than to lose more time later."
Garion reached back and rubbed at his neck where the chain of the curiously carved silver amulet Wolf and Aunt Paul had given him for Eristide had chafed his skin.
"Don't worry at it, dear," Aunt Paul told him.
"I wish you'd let me wear it outside my clothes," he complained. "Nobody can see it under my tunic."
"It has to be next to your skin."
"Well, it's not very comfortable. It looks nice enough, I suppose. But sometimes it seems cold, and other times it's hot, and once in a while it seems to be awfully heavy. The chain keeps rubbing at my neck. I guess I'm not used to ornaments."
"It's not entirely an ornament, dear. You'll get used to it in time."
Wolf laughed.
"Maybe it will make you feel better to know that it took your aunt 10 years to get used to hers. I was forever telling her to put it back on."
"I don't know that we need to go into that just now, father,"
Aunt Paul answered coolly.
"Do you have one, too?"
Garion asked the old man, suddenly curious about it.
"Of course."
"Does it mean something that we all wear them?"
"It is a family custom, Garion," Aunt Paul told him, in a tone that ended the discussion. The fog eddied around them as a chill, damp breeze briefly swirled through the ruins. Garion sighed.
"I wish Hetar would get here. I'd like to get away from this place. It's like a graveyard." "It was not always this way,"
Aunt Paul said very quietly.
"Well, what was it like?" "I was happy here. The walls were high and the towers soared. We all thought it would last forever."
She pointed toward a rank patch of winter-browned brambles creeping over the broken stones.
"Over there was a flower-filled garden where ladies in pale yellow dresses used to sit while young men sang to them from beyond the garden wall. The voices of the young men were very sweet, and the ladies would sigh and throw bright red roses over the wall to them, and down that avenue was a marble-paved square where the old men met to talk of forgotten wars and long-gone companions. Beyond that, there was a house with a terrace where I used to sit with friends in the evening to watch the stars come out, while a boy brought up chilled fruit and the nightingales sang as if their hearts were breaking."
Her voice drifted off into silence.
"But then the Asturians came," she went on,
"and there was a different note then.
You would be surprised at how little time it takes to tear down something that took 1,000 years to build."
"Don't worry at it, Paul," Wolf told her. "These things happen from time to time. There's not a great deal we can do about it."
"I could have done something, father," she replied, looking off into the ruins. "But you would not let me, remember?"
"Do we have to go over that again, Paul?"
Wolf asked in a pained voice.
"You have to learn to accept your losses. The Wasaderons were doomed anyway. At best, you would have only been able to stall off the inevitable for a few months. We are not who we are, and what we are, in order to get mixed up in things that don't have any meaning.
So you said before.
She looked around at the filmy trees, marching away in the fog down the empty streets.
I did not think the trees would come back so fast,
she said with a strange little catch in her voice.
I thought they might have waited a little longer.
It's been almost 25 centuries, Paul.
Really? It seems like only last year.
Don't brood about it. It will only make you melancholy. Why don't we go inside? The fog's beginning to make us all a bit moody.
Unaccountably, Aunt Paul put her arm around Geryon's shoulders as they turned toward the tower. Her fragrance and the sense of her closeness brought a lump to his throat. The distance that had grown between them in the past few months seemed to vanish at her touch. The chamber in the base of the tower had been built of such massive stones that neither the passage of centuries, nor the silent probing tendrils of the tree roots, had been able to dislodge them. Great shallow arches supported the low stone ceiling, making the room seem almost like a cave. At the end of the room, opposite the narrow doorway, a wide crack between two of the rough-hewn blocks provided a natural chimney. Durnek had soberly considered the crack the previous evening, when they had arrived cold and wet, and then had quickly constructed a crude but efficient fireplace out of the rubble.
"It'll serve," the smith had said. "Not very elegant, perhaps, but good enough for a few days."
As Wolf, Geryon, and Aunt Paul entered the low, cave-like chamber, a good fire crackled in the fireplace, casting a looming shadow among the low arches and radiating a welcome warmth. Durnek, in his brown leather tunic, was stacking firewood along the wall.
Marak, huge, red-bearded, and mail-shirted, was polishing his sword.
Silk, in an unbleached linen shirt and black leather vest, lounged idly on one of the packs, toying with a pair of dice.
"Any sign of Hethor yet?"
Varak asked, looking up.
"It's a day or so early,"
Mr. Wolf replied, going to the fireplace to warm himself.
"Why don't you change your boots, Geryon?"
Aunt Paul suggested, hanging her blue cloak on one of the pegs Durnek had hammered into a crack in the wall. Geryon lifted his pack down from another peg and began rummaging through it.
"Your stockings, too?" "Is the fog lifting at all?"
Silk asked Mr. Wolf.
"Not a chance."
"If I can persuade you all to move out from in front of the fire, I will see about supper,"
Aunt Paul told them, suddenly very businesslike. She began setting out a ham, a few loaves of dark peasant bread, a sack of dried peas, and a dozen or so leathery-looking carrots, humming softly to herself as she always did when she was cooking. The next morning, after breakfast, Geryon pulled on a fleece-lined overvest, belted on his sword, and went back out into the fog-muffled ruins to watch for Hethor. It was a task to which he had appointed himself, and he was grateful that none of his friends had seen fit to tell him that it wasn't really necessary. As he trudged through the slush-covered streets toward the broken west gate of the city, he made a conscious effort to avoid the melancholy brooding that had blackened the previous day. Since there was absolutely nothing he could do about his circumstances, chewing on them would only leave a sour taste in his mouth. He was not exactly cheerful when he reached the low piece of wall by the west gate, but he was not precisely gloomy either. The wall offered some protection, but the damp chill still crept through his clothes, and his feet were already cold. He shivered and settled down to wait. There was no point in trying to see any distance in the fog, so he concentrated on listening. His ears began to sort out the sounds in the forest beyond the wall, the drip of water from the trees, the occasional sodden thump of snow sliding from the limbs, and the tapping of a woodpecker working on dead snags several hundred yards away.
"That's my cow," a voice said suddenly from somewhere off in the fog.
Garion froze and stood silently, listening.
"Keep her in your own pasture, then," another voice replied shortly.
"Is that you, Limer?" the first voice asked.
"Right, you're all Dutton, aren't you?"
"I don't recognize you. How long's it been?"
4 or 5 years, I suppose," Limer judged.
"How are things going in your village?" Dutton asked.
"We're hungry. The taxes took all our food."
"Ours, too. We've been eating boiled tree roots."
"Haven't tried that yet. We are eating our shoes."
"How's your wife?" Dutton asked politely.
"She died last year,"
Limer answered in a flat, unemotional voice.
"My lord took our son for a soldier, and he was killed in a battle somewhere. They poured boiling pitch on him. After that, my wife stopped eating. Didn't take her long to die."
"I'm sorry," Dutton sympathized. "She was very beautiful."
"They're both better off," Limer declared. "They aren't cold or hungry anymore. Which kind of tree roots have you been eating?"
"Oh, birch is the best. Spruce has too much pitch and oak's too tough. You boil some grass with the roots to give them a bit of flavor."
"I'll have to try it."
"We've got to get back," Dutton said.
"My lord's got me clearing trees, and he'll have me flogged if I stay away too long." "Maybe I'll see you again sometime."
"If we both live."
"Goodbye." "Goodbye."
The two voices drifted away. Garion stood quite still for a long time after they were gone, his mind numb with shock and with tears of sympathy standing in his eyes. The worst part of it was the matter-of-fact way in which the two had accepted it all. A terrible anger began to burn in his throat. He wanted suddenly to hit somebody. Then there was another sound off in the fog. Somewhere in the forest nearby, someone was singing. The voice was a light, clear tenor, and Garion could hear it quite plainly as it drew closer. The song was filled with ancient wrongs, and the refrain was a call to battle. Irrationally, Garion's anger focused on the unknown singer. His vapid bawling about abstract injustices seemed somehow obscene in the face of the quiet despair of Lamer and Dutton. Without thinking, Garion drew his sword and crouched slightly behind the shattered wall. The song came yet nearer, and Garion could hear the step of a horse's hooves in the wet snow. Carefully, he poked his head out from behind the wall as the singer appeared out of the fog no more than 20 paces away. He was a young man, dressed in yellow hose and a bright red jerkin. His fur-lined cloak was tossed back, and he had a long, curved bow slung over one shoulder and a well-sheathed sword at his opposite hip. His reddish-gold hair fell smoothly down his back from beneath a pointed cap with a feather rising from it. Although his song was grim, and he sang it in a voice throbbing with passion, there was about his youthful face a kind of friendly openness that no amount of scowling could erase. Garion glared at this empty-headed young nobleman, quite certain that the singing fool had never made a meal of tree roots or mourned the passing of a wife who had starved herself to death out of grief. The stranger turned his horse and, still singing, rode directly toward the broken arch of the gateway beside which Garion lurked in ambush. Garion was not normally a belligerent boy, and under other circumstances he might have approached the situation differently. The gaudy young stranger, however, had presented himself at precisely the wrong time. Garion's quickly devised plan had the advantage of simplicity. Since there was nothing to complicate it, it worked admirably. Up to a point. No sooner had the lyric young man passed through the gate than Garion stepped from his hiding place, grasped the back of the rider's cloak, and yanked him bodily out of the saddle. With a startled outcry and a wet splat, the stranger landed unceremoniously on his back in the slush at Garion's feet. The second part of Garion's plan, however, fell completely apart. Even as he moved in to take the fallen rider prisoner at sword point, the young man rolled, came to his feet, and drew his own sword,
seemingly all in one motion. His eyes were snapping with anger, and his sword weaved threateningly. Geryon was not a fencer, but his reflexes were good, and the chores he had performed at Faldor's farm had hardened his muscles. Despite the anger which had moved him to attack in the first place, he had no real desire to hurt this young man. His opponent seemed to be holding his sword lightly, almost negligently, and Geryon thought that a smart blow on the blade might very well knock it out of his hand. He swung quickly, but the blade flicked out of the path of his heavy swipe and clashed with a steely ring down on his own sword. Geryon jumped back and made another clumsy swing. The swords rang again. Then the air was filled with clash and scrape and bell-like rattle as the two of them banged and parried and feinted with their blades. It took Geryon only a moment to realize that his opponent was much better at this than he was, but that the young man had ignored several opportunities to strike at him. In spite of himself, he had begun to grin in the excitement of their noisy contest. The stranger's answering grin was open, even friendly.
"All right. That's enough of that."
It was Mr. Wolf. The old man was striding toward them with Barak and Silk close on his heels.
"Just exactly what do you two think you're doing?"
Geryon's opponent, after one startled glance, lowered his sword.
"Belgarath," he began.
"Leldorin," Wolf's tone was scathing. "Have you lost what little sense you had to begin with?"
Several things clicked into place in Geryon's mind simultaneously as Wolf turned on him coldly.
"Well, Geryon, would you like to explain this?"
Geryon instantly decided to try guile.
"Grandfather,"
he said, stressing the word and giving the younger stranger a quick warning look.
"You didn't think we were really fighting, did you? Leldorin here was just showing me how you block somebody's sword when he attacks. That's all."
"Really?"
Wolf replied skeptically.
"Of course," Geryon said, all innocence now. "What possible reason could there be for us to be trying to hurt each other?"
Leldorin opened his mouth to speak, but Geryon deliberately stepped on his foot.
"Leldorin's really very good,"
he rushed on, putting his hand in a friendly fashion on the young man's shoulder.
"He taught me a lot in just a few minutes."
"Let it stand." Silth's fingers flickered at him in the minute gestures of the Drasnian secret language. "Always keep a lie simple."
"The lad is an apt pupil, Belgarath,"
Leldorin said lamely, finally understanding.
"He's agile, if nothing else,"
Mr. Wolf replied dryly.
"What is the idea behind all the frippery?"
He indicated Leldorin's gaudy clothes.
"You look like a maypole."
"The Mimbrates have started detaining honest Asturians for questioning," the young errand explained. "And I had to pass several of their strongholds. I thought that if I dressed like one of their toadies, I wouldn't be bothered."
"Maybe you've got better sense than I thought,"
Wolf conceded grudgingly. He turned to Silk and Barak.
"This is Leldorin, son of the Baron of Wildentor. He'll be joining us."
"I wanted to talk to you about that, Belgarath," Leldorin put in quickly. "My father commanded me to come here, and I cannot disobey him. But I am pledged in a matter of extremest urgency."
"Every young nobleman in Asturias pledged in at least two or three such matters of urgency. I'm sorry, Leldorin, but the matter we are involved in is much too important to be postponed while you go out to ambush a couple of Mimbrate tax collectors."
Aunt Paul approached them out of the fog then, with Dernick striding protectively at her side.
"What are they doing with the swords, father?"
she demanded, her eyes flashing.
"Playing," Mr. Wolf replied shortly. "So they say. This is Leldorin. I think I have mentioned him to you."
Aunt Paul looked Leldorin up and down with one raised eyebrow.
"A very colorful young man.
The clothes are a disguise. He's not as frivolous as all of that. Not quite, anyway. He's the best bowman in Astoria, and we might need his skill before we're done with all of this.
I see, she said, somewhat unconvinced.
There's another reason, of course, Wolf continued, but I don't think we need to get into that just now, do we?
Are you still worried about that passage, Father? She asked with exasperation. The Mrin Codex is very obscure, and none of the other versions say anything at all about the people it mentions. It could be pure allegory, you know.
I have seen a few too many allegories to know to be plain fact to start gambling at this point. Why don't we all go back to the tower? It's a bit cold and wet out here for lengthy debates on textual variations.
Geryon glanced at Silk, baffled by this exchange, but the little man returned his look with blank incomprehension.
"Will you help me catch my horse, Geryon?" Lodoran asked politely, sheathing his sword.
"Of course," Geryon replied, also putting away his weapon.
"I think he went that way."
Lodoran picked up his bow, and the two of them followed the horse's tracks off into the ruins.
"I'm sorry I pulled you off your horse," Geryon apologized,
when they were out of the sight of the others.
"No matter," Lodoran laughed easily. "I should have been paying more attention."
He looked quizzically at Geryon.
"Why did you lie to Belgareth?"
"It wasn't exactly a lie. We weren't really trying to hurt each other, and sometimes it takes hours trying to explain something like that." Lodoran laughed again. An infectious sort of laugh, in spite of himself, Geryon could not help joining in. Both laughing, they continued together down an overgrown street between the low mounds of slush-covered rubble. Chapter 2 Lodoran of Wildentor was 18 years old, although his ingenuous nature made him seem more boyish. No emotion touched him that did not instantly register in his expression, and sincerity shone in his face like a beacon. He was impulsive, extravagant in his declarations, and probably, Geryon reluctantly concluded, not overly bright. It was impossible not to like him, however. The following morning, when Geryon pulled on his cloak to go out and continue his watch for Hetar, Lodoran immediately joined him. The young errand had changed out of his garish clothing and now wore brown hose, a green tunic, and a dark brown wool cape. He carried his bow and wore a quiver of arrows at his belt. As they walked through the snow toward the broken west wall, he amused himself by loosing arrows at targets only half visible ahead of him. "You're awfully good," Geryon said admiringly, after one particularly fine shot.
"I am an Astorian," Lodoran replied modestly.
"We have been bowmen for 1,000 years. My father had the limbs of this bow cut on the day that I was born, and I could draw it by the time that I was 8.
"I imagine you had a great deal," Geryon said, thinking of the dense forest all around them and the tracks of game he had seen in the snow.
"It is our most common pastime." Lodoran stopped to pull the arrow he had just shot from a tree trunk. "My father prides himself on the fact that beef or mutton are never served at his table."
"I went hunting once in Carrick."
"A deer?"
"No, wild boars. We didn't use bows, though. The Carricks hunt with spears."
"Spears? How can you get close enough to kill anything with a spear?"
Geryon laughed a bit ruefully, remembering his bruised ribs and aching head.
"Getting close isn't the problem. It's getting away after you've speared him that's the difficult part."
Lodoran did not seem to grasp that. "The huntsmen form a line," Geryon explained, "and they crash through the woods, making as much noise as they can. You take your spear and wait where the boars are likely to pass when they try to get away from the noise. Being chased makes them bad-tempered, and when they see you, they charge. That's when you spear them."
"Well, isn't that dangerous?"
Lodoran's eyes were wide. Geryon nodded. I almost got all my ribs broken. He was not exactly boasting, but he admitted to himself that he was pleased by Lodoran's reaction to his story.
We don't have many dangerous animals in Asturia, Lodoran said almost wistfully. A few bears and once in a while a pack of wolves.
He seemed to hesitate for a moment, looking closely at Geryon.
Some men, though, find more interesting things to shoot at than wild stags.
He said it with a kind of secretive sidelong glance.
Oh?
Geryon was not quite sure what he meant.
Hardly a day goes by that some Mimbrate's horse doesn't come home riderless.
Geryon was shocked at that.
Some men think that there are too many Mimbrates in Asturia,
Lodoran explained with heavy emphasis.
I thought that the Arendish civil war was over. There are many who do not believe that. There are many who believe that the war will continue until Asturia is free of the Mimbrate crown.
Lodoran's tone left no question as to where he stood in the matter.
Wasn't the country unified after the Battle of Omimbre?
Geryon objected.
Unified? Well, how could anyone believe that? Asturia is treated like a subject province. The king's court is at Vomimbre. Every governor, every tax collector, every bailiff, every high sheriff in the kingdom is Mimbrate. There is not a single Asturian in a position of authority anywhere in Arendia. The Mimbrites even refuse to recognize our titles. My father, whose line extends back 1,000 years, is called landowner. A Mimbrite would sooner bite out his tongue than call him baron.
Lodoran's face had gone white with suppressed indignation.
I didn't know that, Geryon said carefully,
not sure how to handle the young man's feelings.
Asturia's humiliation is almost at an end, however,
Lodoran declared fervently.
There are some men in Asturia for whom patriotism is not dead, and the time is not far off when these men will hunt royal game.
He emphasized his statement by snapping an arrow at a distant tree. That confirmed the worst of Geryon's fears. Lodoran was a bit too familiar with the details not to be involved in this plot. As if he had realized himself that he had gone too far, Lodoran stared at Geryon with consternation.
Oh, I am a fool, he blurted, with a guilty look around him. I've never learned to control my tongue. Please, forget what I just said, Geryon. I know you are my friend, and I know you won't betray what I said in a moment of heat.
That was one thing Geryon had feared. With that single statement, Lodoran had effectively sealed his lips. He knew that Mr. Wolf should be warned that some wild scheme was afoot, but Lodoran's declaration of friendship and trust had made it impossible for him to speak. He wanted to grind his teeth with frustration as he stared full in the face of a major moral dilemma. They walked on, neither of them speaking and both a little embarrassed, until they reached the bit of a wall where Geryon had waited in ambush the day before. For a time, they stared out into the fog, their strained silence growing more uncomfortable by the moment.
"What is it like in Sindaria?"
Lodoran asked suddenly.
"I have never been there." "There aren't so many trees,"
Geryon answered, looking over the wall at the dark trunks marching off in the fog.
"It's an orderly kind of place. Why did you live there?"
"At Faldor's farm. It's near Lake Arat."
"Is this Faldor a nobleman?"
"Faldor? No, Faldor's as common as old shoes. He's just a farmer. Decent, honest, good-hearted. I miss him."
"A commoner, then,"
Lodoran said, seeming ready to dismiss Faldor as a man of no consequence.
"Rank doesn't mean very much in Sindaria,"
Geryon told him rather pointedly.
"What a man does is more important than what he is."
He made a wry face.
"I was a scullery boy. Not very pleasant, but somebody's got to do it, I suppose.
Oh, not a serf, certainly.
Leldoran sounded shocked.
There aren't any serfs in Sindaria.
No serfs?
The young Aaron stared at him uncomprehendingly.
No,
Garion said firmly.
We've never found it necessary to have serfs.
Leldoran's expression clearly showed that he was baffled by the notion. Garion remembered the voices that had come to him out of the fog the day before, but he resisted the urge to say something about serfdom. Leldoran would never understand, and the two of them were very close to friendship. Garion felt that he needed a friend just now, and he did not want to spoil things by saying something that would offend this likable young man.
"What sort of work does your father do?"
Leldoran asked politely.
"He's dead. So is my mother."
Garion found that if he said it quickly, it did not hurt so much. Leldoran's eyes filled in sudden, impulsive sympathy. He put his hand consolingly on Garion's shoulder.
"Oh, I'm sorry,"
his voice almost breaking.
"It must have been a terrible loss."
"I was a baby,"
Garion shrugged, trying to sound offhanded about it.
"I don't even remember them."
It was still too personal to talk about.
"Some pestilence?"
Leldoran asked gently.
"No," Garion answered in the same flat tone. "They were murdered."
Leldoran gasped, and his eyes went wide.
"A man crept into their village at night and set fire to their house,"
Garion continued unemotionally.
"My grandfather tried to catch him, but he got away. From what I understand, the man is a very old enemy of my family."
"Oh, surely you're not going to let it stand like that?"
Leldoran demanded.
"No,"
Garion replied, still looking out into the fog.
"As soon as I'm old enough, I'm going to find him and kill him."
"Good lad!"
Leldoran exclaimed, suddenly catching Garion in a rough embrace.
"We will find him and cut him to pieces."
"We?
Well, I'll be going with you, of course,"
Leldoran declared.
"No true friend could do any less."
He was obviously speaking on impulse, but just as obviously he was totally sincere. He gripped Garion's hand firmly.
"I swear to you, Garion, I will not rest until the murderer of your parents lies dead at your feet."
The sudden declaration was so totally predictable that Garion silently berated himself for not keeping his mouth shut. His feelings in the matter were very personal, and he was not really sure he wanted company in his search for his faceless enemy. Another part of his mind, however, rejoiced in Leldoran's impulsive but unquestioning support. He decided to let the subject drop. He knew Leldoran well enough by now to realize that the young man undoubtedly made a dozen devout promises a day, quickly offered in absolute sincerity, and just as quickly forgotten. They talked then of other things, standing close together beside the shattered wall with their dark cloaks drawn tightly around them. Shortly before noon, Garion heard the muffled sound of horses' hooves somewhere out in the forest. A few minutes later, Hetar materialized out of the fog with a dozen wild-looking horses trailing after him. The tall Algar wore a short, fleece-lined leather cape. His boots were mud-spattered and his clothes travel-stained, but otherwise he seemed unaffected by his 2 weeks in the saddle.
"Garion," he said gravely, by way of greeting, and Garion and Leldoran stepped out to meet him.
"We've been waiting for you,"
Garion told him, and introduced Leldoran.
"We'll show you where the others are."
Hetar nodded, and followed the two young men through the ruins to the tower where Mr. Wolf and the others were waiting.
"Snow in the mountains,"
the Algar remarked laconically by way of explanation as he swung down from his horse.
"It delayed me a bit."
He pulled his hood back from his shaved head and shook out his long black scalp lock.
"No harm's been done,"
Mr. Wolf replied.
"Come inside to the fire and have something to eat. We have got a lot to talk about."
Hetar looked at the horses, his tan, weathered face growing strangely blank,
as if he were concentrating. The horses all looked back at him, their eyes alert and their ears pointed sharply forward. Then they turned and picked their way off among the trees.
"Won't they stray?" Durnick wanted to know.
"No," Petar answered.
"I ask them not to."
Durnick looked puzzled, but he let it pass. They all went into the tower and sat near the fireplace. Aunt Paul cut dark bread and pale yellow cheese for them while Durnick put more wood on the fire.
"Kohag sent word to the clan chiefs," Petar reported, pulling off his cape.
He wore a black long-sleeved horsehide jacket with steel discs riveted to it to form a kind of flexible armor.
"They are gathering at the stronghold for council."
He unbelted the curved saber he wore, laid it to one side, and sat near the fire to eat.
Wolf nodded. "Is anyone trying to get through to Prolgo?" "I sent a troop of my own men to the Gorum before I left,"
Petar responded.
"They will get through if anyone can."
"I hope so," Wolf stated.
"The Gorum's an old friend of mine, and I'll need his help before all of this is finished."
"Aren't your people afraid of the land of the Ulgos?"
Lalduran inquired politely.
"I have heard that there are monsters there that feed on the flesh of men."
Petar shrugged.
"They stay in their lairs in the wintertime. Besides, they are seldom brave enough to attack a full troop of mounted men."
He looked over at Mr. Wolf.
"Southern Sindaria is crawling with Murgos. Or did you know that?"
"I could have guessed. Did they seem to be looking for anything in particular?"
"I do not talk with Murgos,"
Petar said shortly. His hooked nose and fierce eyes made him look at that moment like a hawk about to swoop down to the kill.
"I'm surprised that you were not delayed even more," Silk bantered. "The whole world knows how you feel about Murgos."
"I indulged myself once," Petar admitted.
"I met two of them, alone on the highway. It did not take very long."
"Two less to worry about then," Breck grunted with approval.
"I think it's time for some plain talk,"
Mr. Wolf said, brushing crumbs off the front of his tunic.
"Most of you have some notion of what we are doing, but I don't want anybody blundering into something by accident. We are after a man named Zidar. He used to be one of my master's disciples. Then he went over to Torak. Early last fall, he somehow slipped into the throne room at Riva and stole the Orb of Aldur. We are going to chase him down and get it back."
"Isn't he a sorcerer too?"
Beric asked, tugging absently at a thick red braid.
"That is not the term we use. But yes, he does have a certain amount of that kind of power. We all did. Me, Beltira, and Belkira, Belzidar, all the rest of us. That's one of the things I wanted to warn you about."
"You all seem to have the same sort of names," Silk noticed.
"Our master changed our names when he took us as disciples. It was a simple change, but it meant a great deal to us."
"Wouldn't that mean that your original name was Gareth?" Silk asked, his ferret eyes narrowing shrewdly.
Mr. Wolf looked startled and then laughed.
"I haven't heard that name for thousands of years. I have been Belgarath for so long that I had almost completely forgotten Gareth. It's probably just as well. Gareth was a troublesome boy, a thief and a liar, among other things."
"Some things never change," Aunt Paul observed.
"Nobody's perfect," Wolf admitted blandly.
"Why did Zadar steal the orb?"
Petar asked, setting aside his plate.
"He has always wanted it for himself," the old man replied. "That could be it. But more likely he's trying to take it to Torak. The one who delivers the orb to One Eye is going to be his favorite."
"But Torak is dead," Lalduran objected.
"The Riven Warder killed him at Vomimbre."
"No, Torak is not dead, only asleep.
Bran's sword was not the one destined to kill him. Zedar carried him off after the battle, and hid him someplace. Some day he will awaken. Probably some day very soon, if I am reading the signs right. We have got to get the orb back before that happens.
These Zedars caused a lot of trouble, Varric rumbled. You should have dealt with him a long time ago.
Possibly, Wolf admitted.
Why don't you just wave your hand and make him disappear?
Varric suggested, making a sort of gesture with his thick fingers. Wolf shook his head.
I can't. Not even the gods can do that.
Well, we've got some big problems then, Silk said with a frown. Every Murgo from here to Rakgoska's going to try to stop us from catching Zedar.
Not necessarily, Wolf disagreed.
Zedar's got the orb, but Tochik commands the Grolems.
Tochik?
Lalduran asked. The Grolem High Priest. He and Zedar hate each other. I think we can count on him to try to keep Zedar from getting to Torak with the orb.
Varric shrugged. What difference does it make? You and Pulgara can use magic if we run into anything difficult, can you not?
There are limitations on that sort of thing, Wolf said a bit evasively.
I don't understand, Varric said, frowning.
Mr. Wolf took a deep breath.
All right, as long as it's come up, let's go into that too. A sorcery, if that's what you want to call it, is a disruption of the natural order of things. Sometimes it has certain unexpected effects, so you have to be very careful about what you do with it. Not only that, it makes... He frowned then. Well, let's call it a sort of noise. That's not exactly what it is, but it serves well enough to explain. Others with the same abilities can hear the noise. Once Pulgara and I start changing things, every Grolem in the West is going to know exactly where we are and what we are doing. They'll keep piling things in front of us until we're exhausted.
It takes almost as much energy to do things that way as it does to do them with your arms and back, Aunt Paul explained. It is very tiring.
She sat beside the fire, carefully mending a small tear in one of Geryon's tunics.
I didn't know that, Varric admitted.
Not many people do.
If we have to, Paul and I can take certain steps, Wolf went on. But we can't keep it up forever. And we can't simply make things vanish. I'm sure you can see why.
Oh, of course, Silk professed, though his tone indicated that he did not.
Everything that exists depends on everything else, Aunt Paul explained quietly. If you were to unmake one thing, it is altogether possible that everything would vanish.
The fire popped, and Geryon jumped slightly. The vaulted chamber seemed suddenly dark, and shadows lurked in the corners.
That cannot happen, of course, Wolf told them.
When you try to unmake something, your will simply recoils on you. If you say, be not, then you are the one who vanishes.
That's why we are very careful about what we say.
Now I can understand why, Silk said, his eyes widening slightly.
Most of the things we will encounter can be dealt with by ordinary means. That is the reason we have brought you together. At least, that's one of the reasons. Among you, you will be able to handle most of the things that get in our way.